Shopomaniacs, buenos días a Shop Talk Show. Me llamo Dave Rupert y conmigo es el jefe de CSS Tricks, el señor Chris Coyer.
Hey, hola. Yeah, Dave's just shaking the sand out of his sandals back from a trip on the beach.
Always good times. How are you, Chris? Welcome back. We still talking about websites? Are they still around?
For better or worse, Dave, they still are. And we have somebody who's probably shakes the sand out of his sandals every day down in Florida. Scott Jell. Hey, Scott.
Hey. Or hola, rather.
Indeed.
I've actually used all the Spanish I possess, so we can switch.
I was impressed. I apologize. Dude. All
right.
I was too. Dang it. And jealous a little bit, you know. Yeah. What about your kids, Dave? Are you going to Spanish them up? And you know, Texas probably has lots of Spanish speaking action.
Oh, I should. Well, we should. And just more discerning parents send their kids to bilingual schools and set them on a path. Our kids are. Like not my son.
Shame you, Dave. I don't care. I just think it's
interesting. My son. This is the only kid story I'll share here. Okay. My son was like, "Hey, Dad, I know how to say water in Spanish." And I was like, "Oh, wow, man, I'm so glad they're teaching you. How do you say it?" And he goes, "Wata." And I was like, "That is not it."
Good effort, though. The interest is there.
Yeah, he just makes up Spanish words, which I don't know if that's good or bad. And then he also draws Chinese characters, like Japanese kanji, on his body. So, as like tattoos. Mm. Who knows?
High points for creativity, low points for accuracy. Yeah. I'll take creativity any day.
Yeah,
He's an artist. I just ran into Scott in Seattle. We were there for an event apart. A little conference series kind of thing that we were both speaking at. So that was cool, huh?
Yeah, great conference. It was good.
This has been your kind of vibe for a while, maybe forever. You wrote a book also called Responsive Design, which is, you know, thematically related to the name of your talk was Move Fast and Don't Break Things. Like, what can you give us a sense of your, like, where you're at, what you like thinking and talking about when it comes to this making website stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in the case of that book title, it's sort of an additive thing. It's not that, you know, responsive design was irresponsible by default, but it's more of, you know, integrating other aspects of the priorities that people should care about when they're building websites these days. So making an interface respond to different viewport sizes would be definitely one of those. But on top of that, I've been kind of focusing on the intersection of performance and accessibility with those other aspects of responsive design. And I think that's kind of an interesting place to exist, you know, because they all sort of complement each other, but there are challenges that, you know, you kind of have to make them all work together, I think. So
it's an interesting time for the accessibility talk too. It's always an issue, but it always seems to be coming to a head in a new way. You know, maybe the hot topics right now are, is this, you know, new JavaScript heavy world of front end development a kind of net loss for accessibility, or is there potential for a net gain there, or what's the conversation like that about? Then there's this big WebAIM study that was published that basically just says, like, hey, it's been bad, was bad, has been bad, is bad, gonna be bad,
potentially getting worse, right? Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think the promise of any framework is that it should make things like accessibility easier to attain. And I've seen that firsthand. I mean, I was on the jQuery mobile team for quite a while, and we had a huge accessibility focus on that project. And I would like to think that it helped people build apps on the web that were more accessible, you know, more easily than it would have been if they were trying to build the same thing without any framework or
sure. I remember it was kind of like, there was a lot of sliding happening in that app.
At the time it was, I mean, it was kind of early stages of the same sort of transition we're seeing now into more, you know, I don't know, single page kind of experiences where things right. animate and transition between views instead of a full refresh and all that. So we were doing that, but
which is sometimes desirable because of a native app can do that. And it's so, I guess it's been proven to be a pretty nice design pattern. And because we literally can't do that, there is no way to do that if the whole page refreshes, which would be interesting if the native web took that on as a possibility. But if you want to like slide out of one page and slide in another page, you're kind of in SPA territory. But with that comes this whole slew of kind of performance challenges and accessibility challenges and stuff. And you took them head on ages ago with jQuery Mobile. That's interesting.
Yeah. I think, you know, we had a lot of people helping us out with screen reader testing and, it was definitely challenging though. And especially as soon as you introduce those aspects of, you know, sort of reproducing what a browser does well, with JavaScript, you have to own a lot of behavior that you wouldn't otherwise need to do. Right. So like if you're refreshing the page, you have to update the URL in a way that, you know, makes sense and is deep linkable and, notify the user of what changed in the interface. I mean, there's a whole lot the browser does for us, as you know, that, once all of a sudden you need to do yourself. Right.
Lately I've been thinking about, I think this is empower. Like, let's say you're an HTML CSS person and you're taking your first steps into JavaScript. There are lots of people in this scenario, lots of people going through curriculum perhaps in school that's like this. I remember it pretty clearly back in the jQuery days as well, as that was my first step into JavaScript. And I remember how powerful it was when you learn how to change a class.
Right.
You know, toggle it on and off, change it from one class to another class or whatever. And if that's the one thing that you know how to do in JavaScript as a designer, developer, taking their first steps into JavaScript or whatever, it's so empowering, especially if you know CSS well. You know, you're like, oh, let me, you know, okay, that class is gone now, so I can slide away something. I can slide in something new. I can hide a tab and reveal another tab and add an active class on the, you know, on the actual tab part of the tab, so I can have it have a special background color to signal that it's active. And I was thinking how cool that felt and how powerful I now am as a designer. And now I think back on that and be like, I wonder if that was dangerous in a way, because the minute you're into that, all you're doing is changing classes and worrying about what it looks like, only to find out later that it's like, I didn't deal with focus, I didn't deal with keyboard events, I didn't deal with ARIA roles that are relevant to this. I didn't do any of that work.
Right. It's almost maybe more of a useful model to think about styling against ARIA attributes these days, or, you know, something that's, you know, just sort of like more tightly couples you to the accessible version of the thing already, since classes are just, you know, not really.
Even that worries me sometimes, because there's this talking point that, like, I almost feel unqualified here a little bit, but there's this, I think it was even part of that report too, like websites that use ARIA roles are generally worse than ones that don't.
Yeah.
And it was so, like,
it takes a lot of work, and I can't claim to, you know, to have it down either, but it takes so much research and work to find the right patterns, because, yeah, I mean, it just gives you so many tools to expose more meaning of what's going on. But it's really, it can be hard to figure out which particular combination of ARIA attributes are right for each situation. And more often than not, I've found that when we go into testing with people who use screen readers every day and also happen to, you know, have a development background, we end up refactoring to something simpler than we started with, you know.
Oh wow.
Yeah. You think the ARIA role equals menu would be super helpful to like construct a menu. It is not. It is absolutely like almost not for that.
Collapsible elements that I always marked up as sort of a menu pattern like you're talking about, and later realized that, you know, just a button that precedes a div that shows and hides with relatively little information about that, as long as the button says, you know, toggle the thing that comes next in so many words,
yeah,
that can be preferable, you know? So it's hard to know those patterns. I mean, you know, to your credit, that Accessibility Project site has some really good examples of patterns that you can start with.
Yeah, well, I think that was just born out of my own ignorance. I was just like, we have to boil this ocean and kind of come down to figure out how it actually works, you know?
So, yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah, I was thinking back to like the, you have to do everything, like when you're in SPA territory. Even this morning, I you know, I was looking at this app, you know, with the hamburger menu on my phone, mm-hmm. and it's like a Nuxt app. And, you know, I click a link and I'm like, well, nothing happened. And I was like, oh, it's all behind the hamburger menu. So now I have to, like, instead of like a page refresh, like closing, like destroying everything and closing the hamburger, I have to like, okay, now I have to like go through and like hook into the router or something and on some page event thing, like set the is menu expanded, you know, global state variable to none or false. And then like, you know, it's like, you know, there's like a tipping point where you like, you're like, yay, convenience. Oh no, now everything's my responsibility.
Yeah. It's amazing how that adds up to, you know, it can start as such a simple problem. And then, you know, you reach a certain point where all of a sudden you have all this complexity to manage. And I mean, I've thought about even just like the classic example of a custom select menu that, you know, in the past we would kind of make the decision of using a native select or not based on whether or not we needed to style the option elements in a certain way, mm-hmm. like say with like, country flags or something like that, that you just couldn't do otherwise, you know, putting icons in them, especially on mobile platforms. And so we would go that route. Okay, you know, we'll use a, you know, an unordered list and we'll mark it up with ARIA and we'll start to toggle. And all of a sudden we've got, you know, 1,000+ lines of JavaScript toggling everything. And we basically have built an app just for this, you know, this little component. Right.
I mean, and the keyboard stuff is tricky as well.
Yes, all those absolutely.
Arrow keys need to work and the enter key needs to work. But is it always the enter key or is it sometimes, you know, does the escape key need to be bound or something too? And then there's cross-browser differences with that. Very tricky. I have to have I have an app right now that has a native select menu in it, which is great. I error on doing that. And wasn't it you who recently wrote a little bit like, oh, it's actually gotten a lot better recently?
Kind yeah. Of? Yeah. I did put an article up recently that, you know, it's sort of built on a past article that Todd from Filament, had written that got it most of the way there. There were a couple workarounds with that were required for, you know, Internet Explorer.
You can kind of unset things, right? You can kind of
and there were, you know,
appearance none kind of thing and build it up from scratch, but there's still problems with that.
Yeah, and some, you know, before and after kind of hacks. And I believe an early iteration even had like a wrapper element or something around the select just to, you know, get a background.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that recent take was like, you know, how close are we now? Can we just style this stupid thing?
you can. And it's such good work. Yeah. I remember using it that day when it came out. I was like,
that's great. Yeah. So it's totally doable now. I mean, it falls back pretty
much. But here, the situation I'm in is here, look, we have this new, you know, like it can, I'm populating it with X number of things, right? There's a server call that what's in that drop-down menu is dynamic based on user generated content. So I can't, we're trying to avoid ever writing queries that return X, you know, that return infinite number of things, right? Like everything's got to be paginated or whatever, of course. And so then what? It's kind of like you want to build this UI then that has 10 items in it, but little arrows too, so that if you don't find the one you're looking for, you can paginate through them. And then it's like, can we still get away with the native select, or does that complicate things? Because it's to rip things out of a native select and put them back in. Is that acceptable?
There are just those little features that always seem to put you over the hill onto custom menu land, and then it's just a whole new problem, right? I mean, like, I can picture, a select that has multi-select, for example, and you might want at the bottom of the list to be able to clear all the checks or something like that with a little button. I mean, stuff that's just really common in faceted search and, you know, any.
I was looking at one yesterday. I don't know why this is so pertinently perfect here. Atlassian has a style guide thing or a pattern library, and their select menu is like hot. It is really, it's got all the stuff you could ever want. The keyboard stuff, theoretically the accessibility stuff. I can't vouch for that. So I'm sure if it really got drilled for accessibility, it could find problems. But it looked good to me. I was like, wow, these keyboard events work. It's got single select, multi-select, clearing the selects, country select, you know, all the, I was like, dang, this is slick.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of the point of view now that if you have to creep into the, you know, custom select land, then really we should be adopting something that's, you know, pre-built and open source and like that Atlassian one that's really been.
Right. You know, can you imagine listening to this conversation and be like, I don't have any of these problems, y'all. I use Bootstrap or I use whatever because I'm afraid of those problems. And this framework has promised to deliver me freedom from those problems.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, getting back to the whole question you started with, I think, you know, that's hopefully, despite that WebAIM article and the findings, I mean, it was sort of damning to see that, you know, the impact of modern frameworks on accessibility has been negative so far. But I would hope that, you know, with a little change in priorities amongst the teams, of those particular frameworks, that it could be a dramatically good thing, you know?
It might be. Yeah, maybe. We could at least hope that little changes of accessibility things can go further because of the massive adoption of them.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. So much to think about here. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Netlify. Oh, they're so good. I dig near tear up thinking about how good Netlify is sometimes. It's like a host for your files, but of course it just does so much more than that. But if you just focus on that for a minute, I feel like most uses of it is kind of like repo based. You tell Netlify, hey, I've got this repo of files. It's on GitHub or wherever. And it just like, you're like, just watch the master branch. And if I push something to master branch, of course, this is all configurable, then just deploy it. And the deployment is like, they'll give you a URL that it's pointed at, of course, but you can map it to whatever URL you want, of course. But then it also gives you all these little immutable URLs for every push. So if you you can have it like build like another branch for you, like watch my feature branch, and it'll give you a little special URL to check out that. So you can like, you know, it's like your free little staging environment to check out before it goes live. And their hosting is like static in like the best possible way. You know, it's like even all your HTML, CSS, JavaScript files, whatever, Jamstack, yeah, are hosted like on the edge, like in CDN. So they're just smoking fast. These like immutable deploys that are easy to roll back and change. And not change, because that's the point of immutability, but you know what I mean? Like just push a new version of it. You know, they just are these URLs that just last forever with every push you make. It's incredible. But so it's Jamstack, so it's super fast, but then like, could you host your React app there? Absolutely, because then that's the JavaScript and APIs part, the first two letters of Jamstack. Well, then it hits some data source somewhere and gets the data that it needs and becomes the application it was meant to be. Or you're running like a static site generator and you're just deploying the whole dist folder of the whole site. You know, I've used it that way. I have this conferences.csstricks.com kind of mini site where I'm tracking all these upcoming conferences that have to do with front-end web design and development. It's built with 11T. It's using Netlify CMS to help me manage the content on it. It's just such a beautiful setup. I love it. So anyway, check out Netlify. It's sweet. You're definitely not going to regret it. So you talked about lots of more stuff at your talk. I don't know. One thing that was on my mind is when you mentioned that select menu and basically you're designing a whole app there. I thought of Dave's kind of jokey sentiment that comes up relative, like if you have a card component, basically it's a website.
Right. Yeah. It's funny how that, you know, I think any developer has the same sort of mindset where you look at it, you look at the problem initially, you don't see the scope that it could become one day. You just see what it is at that moment and you think, oh, I could write a very small amount of code to handle this and it'll be really elegant. And, you know, that's a dangerous place to start, I've learned, because it just grows, you know, with feature additions. And all of a sudden you get to a point where your code that you've written has become difficult to maintain and you need actually something much fuller featured. And it's a really painful point where you need to integrate that, you know, decide to integrate that framework or whatever it is.
We've been talking a lot about frameworks, but I think you occupy an interesting position, like in the JavaScript community in a way. Respected JavaScript author Scott Gell, you know, working on the web for a long time, speaker at conferences is all over, works at an agency that builds big websites for big clients and delivers, and you're on a small team and all that stuff, but are definitely not a framework guy. Like, I don't think you've tossed your hat in the ring for any particular framework. In fact, if you hear Scott talking about JavaScript, it's usually about some lower level, you know, service workers or whatnot, or something very fundamentally performance related or something. And that's just interesting.
Yeah, I guess that would be an accurate depiction of what we're doing these days. I mean, it's always very dependent on what our, you know, we're an agency, we work for clients, and whatever our mm-hmm. clients happen to be using at the time is, you know, the type of site that we will be either building fresh or, you know, most often just sort of adding to and improving for them. So, you know, at the moment we don't have many clients who are doing React sites, for example, if that's, you know, the framework that we're referring to, or Vue or something like that. We are using Vue more and more. I really like Vue for documentation. So, you know, not necessarily running Vue on the site side itself, like the user facing side, but we use it in our docs to make all these like little you know, component pages really smart, so they can the client.
So Vue Press or your own Vue?
Just little Vue one off templates. Okay. You know? Yeah. But you know, that's for our current clients. That's sort of the extent of it. But I mean, I've been on teams in the past that, you know, I was on the jQuery team I made the jQuery logo. I was there since the very beginning.
Hey!
But so I'm not.
That's a fun fact I didn't know. The yeah. little crescent moons of love there is a Scott Gell design.
Yeah, it's so actually, and you may know this, but you know, the original jQuery logo was a Devo hat, and it was new wave JavaScript, and at one point decided, you know, we needed to give it an evolution. And those crescent moons are in the negative space, a Devo hat, if you kind of look at
it. Oh, yeah.
With a certain eye. But
yes, I see.
Yeah, so it's still got that you know, throwback to that band.
What does John Rezik smell like? Sorry, I'm off topic. Let's...
I think he smells like Japanese ink, you know?
I bet, yeah. 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 Because he's always steeped in study with that mm-hmm. stuff. Yeah. John's a wonderful guy. Been out of touch for a little while, actually, trying to keep up with. He's really into the GraphQL world these days, I think.
Yeah. With Con.
Amen. Yeah. So good.
But I've been following Filament's work for quite a while. It's surely been mentioned here on Shop Talk multiple times, but you know, you very much embrace progressive enhancement. That's a very huge, I guess I would say, tenet of your agency.
Yeah.
It seems. So this kind of series that we've been doing has kind of been about modern JavaScript and kind of touching on frameworks. And as somebody who kind of does not necessarily prescribe to a framework. What, like, how does progressive enhancement and even frameworklessness, what does that look like in this modern JavaScript era?
Yeah, well, I mean, just I don't know, just to sort of clarify, you know, we would happily be working on, you know, any sort of framework project if that was, you know, the requirement or our recommendation for a particular site we're working on. And I think there's a certain type of site and more types of sites that fit that model these days. But a lot of our clients right now are in retail, and they tend to be on platforms like, you know, Demandware, things like that. and those aren't
Magento.
Those are more, I guess,
some sort of,
yeah, exactly. So it's more of a traditional, like, static sort of, you know, super heavy traffic, you know, CDN heavy kind of setup, where really the page, once it's served, is not, it's not a live app in the same way that you would need, you know, data binding for throughout a whole page. That said, we have, you know, sections of these sites that are more, you know, data bound like that. And in some cases, we'll use a framework for small sections like that. But yeah, I think, you know, more and more, it seems like the React and Vue kind of communities have really been embracing more of a progressive enhancement and performance, you know, priority, you know, with like server-side rendering and all of that as sort of like a first-class pattern. That's just sort of like there.
It feels almost first class. I don't know if I'd call any of them totally first class yet.
Yeah,
you know, like, it'd be interesting to see a library that says we're SSR first, and then all this dynamic stuff.
Yeah, and I would love that. I mean, but it's a big step, I would think, from where these started, right? Because even a few years ago, we were having this, especially with like the Ember community, like there was this pain point, right, where like all of the work was being done on the browser side. And a lot of us were making a lot of noise about this, right? And saying like, you know, we're not capable of doing this work, but we would love to see it, you know, like from all these framework teams, we really need to see more of this work shifted to the server or, you know, so that it can happen in both. And, you know, teams like Ember and React and Vue, all of those support it.
Well, there's performance concerns about it too, which is good. But just yesterday, I watched a video. I was like, oh, this is interesting. Google has released a video series called JavaScript SEO. So it's, you know, Google employees sitting there talking about what's the true story of JavaScript rendered apps and their web searcher, which I'm like, that's unusual. I feel like you get little bites of information, you know, Google will say like, oh yeah, we render JavaScript or we don't or whatever, but this is just a video and you can watch it. And it's like 3 minutes long and it just says, look, yes, there's traditional web crawler search. We look at the HTML, we look through it, we find a link. If we find a link, we start over and search through that link and whatever. And it's super fast. And we've looked through literally trillions of individual web URLs. Mm-hmm. Cool. That's really fast. We've gotten really good at that. Then we determine if there's JavaScript doing rendering on that page. And if there is, it goes into another bucket. It goes into, this is really expensive and a lot harder for us to deal with.
Right.
So we're gonna look at it, but like later, like it's just going to be slower and harder. It's just the way it is.
I'm not sure the source of it, but I remember hearing or reading that it's somewhat like a 1 week delay or something.
A week? Wow, I wouldn't have even guessed that. But yeah, oh sure, okay, and I could probably keep watching these.
That in the notes. No. Yeah, I remember it being long though.
Yeah, and not only a week for that first time, but every time there's an update too. Like if you change content on the site, they're saying that's really slow too. And they say, you know, quote from the videos, we can't make any promises. And I'm like, okay, well, if Google's literally telling that to our faces, this has now become a big deal. Like I always kind of punted on the SEO thing, be like, I don't know, it's Google. They make their job search. They got to figure it out. Yeah, it's like this is a big deal, so they'll figure it out, you know. But if they're straight up saying like this is actually really hard for us, we're talking a week between updates. And I know, don't put that in the show notes, whatever. But it's something like that. They've literally said a delay or not at all. That's a big deal. You got to get it's for a if you're going to be like, oh, well, we're going to make our news site client side rendered only. Boy, you've just, you know, Google telling you you're shooting yourself in the foot there.
Yeah. So there's that part. And also out of Google and teams there, we've seen some articles recently, like Adi Asmani posted about the delays we're seeing, even when it is server side rendered, that delay between when you get the initial page and when it's what they call rehydrated, you know, even if it's, from my understanding, even if it's the same content, it still needs to be rehydrated in such a way that it can be bound to the data model, which means, you know, replacing out a lot of the markup with event bound markup. Does that sound about right to you?
It does, but I wonder if that would be a whole new level of if you could SSR but still get penalized because you eventually rehydrate. Oh, that would suck.
Yeah, well, his article just highlighted, and he actually showed a kind of a state where the page is actually blank.
SSR, sure. And then the page gets wiped out. I saw that too. What's up with that? Why would
it
ever
do that?
I'm
not sure if that was for illustration purposes or not, because, you know, I've written about this too in a different context with client-side A-B testing. You see this problem actually a lot. You know, most retail sites do personalization and things like that on their landing pages and homepages now. And it is a huge problem. You know, you get these JavaScript files that are served to the client long after the page has already rendered. And once they spin up, they take up to, you know, 10 seconds sometimes on a mobile device. And then they just completely wipe out a section of the page and replace it with something that's, you know, supposed to be more appropriate or contextual to whoever is browsing. And, you know, it works to a certain extent, but, you know, in conversion, but the cost there is huge. You know, it actually does have like a first rendering and then a much later, a second one that's different. And that could be long after you started using the page.
It's kind of no wonder Netlify has made a bit of a hoopla about the, like, hey, we can do this for you at the, like, what do you call that? Like a load balancer level kind of thing?
Yeah,
like,
that's very cool. I'm really interested in that pattern right now. You know, like
Cloudflare, that was even in your talk at an event apart, right? This Cloudflare thing?
A little bit. Yeah, we've experimented with just a little bit. Like Cloudflare is the one CDN that we've used to try that pattern out for our clients. And it's kind of neat because they have service worker support on their edge servers. So you can kind of use them in that setting without any of the typical considerations that you would have if you're running a service worker in the browser, like browser support or having to download the thing and install it before it can actually work.
Whoa, seriously? Like how does that work? That a service worker gets executed even if you're in an ancient browser because it happens at some
level? It's basically just a middleware tier that happens to be written in JavaScript or a service worker syntax. So it has nothing to do with, you know, the end browser just gets transformed HTML. But somewhere between the server and the browser is this little edge server that has a service worker running on it, and you can do all sorts of fun things with it. You know, simple text swap, find and replace is
yeah. Kind of so the it basic has so somehow do. It has DOM access too. Even though?
Well, it depends what libraries you load in, and I think there's a cap on the size of dependencies you can bring in, and there's probably a latency issue there too. But what we've done is just sort of text in, text out. So, you know, just like a service worker, you can get the, like on the browser side, you can get the text content of a response, like the body of a response, and manipulate it in any way you want. So like for our clients, we noticed this problem with A-B testing with the frameworks they were using on the client side that had these huge delays. We decided, okay, maybe we could give them a tagging system of sorts in their HTML that they could design these tests just using markup. And we could write
both service worker. Oh, I see. So you ship two divs. One of them is test A and one of them is B. And if it matches some regex or whatever, you just rip out one of the divs.
The worker just kind of looks for these marked up. They use HTML comments, just little marked up tests. Oh. And it says, well, if they're in group B, then let's delete group A from this test and keep the, and just send the HTML along to the browser. So they're neat. I mean, it's a similar scenario to like the cloud functions and all that, you know, kind of different functionality.
I didn't realize that the browser support had nothing to do with it. You can reliably ship that anywhere.
Yeah, it's neat to be able to write a service worker and not think about that part. You know, it either has an error or it doesn't.
Yeah.
Right.
Very cool. Very cool.
This episode is sponsored by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean offers the simplest, most developer-friendly cloud platform. It's optimized to make managing and scaling apps easy with an intuitive API, multiple storage options, integrated firewalls, load balancers, and more. From predictable pricing to flexible configurations to world-class customer support, you'll get access to all the infrastructure services you need to grow. You'll be able to spend less time configuring servers. You can self-host your favorite stacks in one click. Get a ready-to-go LAMP, LEMP, Node.js, OpenFaaS, or a Django server up and running instantly on DigitalOcean, the cloud platform developers love. You can explore the growing library of one-click apps on DigitalOcean Marketplace. And for ShopTalk Show listeners, you can get started today with a free $100 credit by visiting do.co/shoptalk. That's do.co/shoptalk for your $100 credit to get started with DigitalOcean today. Our thanks to DigitalOcean for sponsoring this episode of ShopTalk Show.
Speaking of service workers, there's some interesting stuff in your talk about. So we've talked on this show, maybe, you know, I think the Filament Group website uses it. Probably lots of websites are using it these days because I think performance tools like Lighthouse encourage its use. But it's this idea of critical CSS where somehow magically, and I know there's lots of ways to get to here, including automated ways, very manual ways, whatever. But imagine a small chunk of CSS that just enough CSS to make like the top of one page look about right. And you take that and instead of it being in a style sheet that you link up and has to make another request for, it's just chunked right into the HTML. That's called critical CSS, right?
Yeah. 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 And we maintain one of several tools out there that will do that extraction for you. So we would never recommend, you know, going through your CSS and figuring out which rules seem important manually. But yeah, I think it's really powerful when you see it in play to be able to deliver a HTML file with that carries along with it anything that it needs to render immediately when it hits the browser, right? So that's
right.
Not,
and this is like not only SEO stuff, but this is like instant rendering, like just awesome for performance.
Yeah, because you know it starts to you start to pair your initial render time with really like the time to first byte with your server. You know, as soon as the HTML downloads, and it. You know, enough of it lands in the browser, it's ready to go. And that's obviously like, you know, not typical. Most websites on the web, the HTML lands in the browser and the browser looks through it and it says, okay, we can't render yet. We have to go get this style sheet and this JavaScript file. So hold up, we're going to go back to the server. And, you know, there's latency involved there. So that's how we see the average time on really any website. Taking multiple seconds, right? Because it's not ready to render, even though, you know, most sites could render very, very quickly, regardless of how heavy they are, if they carried what they need with them. So yeah, you mentioned the critical CSS thing. That's really just something we recommend when the style sheet for the site is too heavy to just bring along with the page.
Probably most sites,
full.
Though, right?
Sure.
I mean,
yeah,
it
depends. It
15K
does, but,
kind right. of cap-ish, maybe.
Yeah, I would say like 20K-ish when it's, you know, compressed and minified is kind of the point at which it's like, this is a little silly. You should start breaking this into chunks, right? So high priority, low priority. And then there are tools that that can help do that.
So if we're going to really get into the weeds here, the second step is, well, that's great if this HTML file can ship along with it everything it needs for the most part visually, like probably very little JavaScript, but a chunk of CSS, maybe the icons too. We'll get into that in a minute.
Yeah.
If that's a thing. But there is some cost to that too, in that now you have this kind of HTML file that's kind of bigger than it would be normally. It's got all this heavy chunks of code in it the browser needs to grab and parse out and stuff. And I think you're a recent premise or experiment or something, maybe you've even proven it out further than this, is that if we can just grab that chunk and throw it in cache, then the next time we still kind of have our critical CSS ready to go, but it's not inlined. It's, you know, like there's, right? Isn't that?
Yeah, exactly. So I think the pattern you're talking about, I tend to call it like inline cache, or you I think
inline
brought
cache
up,
that's nice.
Yeah, Jeremy Keith after the talk said, I love that pattern, but really it's not inlining, it's embedding. And I thought, oh, okay. But either way, we're talking about, you know, CSS rules that are inside a style element. So whatever you want to call that, it's not the style equals attribute on a div. I think that this particular pattern works for or works best for files that are inlined in their entirety. So it's not, at least to me, it's not as useful for critical CSS, because that particular pattern is sort of like a throwaway step almost. So you bring just the styles you need to render the, you know, a good top portion of the page, and then you also load the full style sheet, right? In a way that doesn't block rendering.
I see. So you never make a file literally called critical.css. Like a lot of times that never even gets made.
Well, we tend to have one per unique template on a site. So, you know, one for the landing template, one for the homepage template, one for a product detail.
So you're
template.
Saying you really do make a file and then inject it in its entirety though, then, right?
Yeah, and its entirety would be, you know, 4 or 5 kilobytes. But the full style sheet is contains all those rules as well, right? So there's a strict overlap.
It's repeated.
There. It's a subset. Right. Yeah. So once we get the full style sheet into the page, that critical CSS is no longer needed. So it's kind of just a first visitor kind of step, right? But to a lot of our clients, that matters a lot, because they're coming from, you know, say a Google search or something like that, straight to a product detail page. They may have, you know, never been to the site before, and we want to spin up that page as quickly as possible. So it's often, you know, it makes a big difference to have a really fast first load as opposed to optimizing for subsequent pages only. But yeah, to get back to the pattern that you were talking about, I think it's really useful when you decide that you'd like to inline an entire file, because on subsequent pages, as you browse around the site, you're going to want to reuse that file again, and you don't want to inline it every time, right? Because then it's kind of wasteful. It's being delivered over and over inside the HTML of all these different pages, and it's, you know, it's bytes downloaded each time that you don't need to do. So what's nice about this pattern is the first time it's sent to the browser, there's a little, like, you know, 5 lines of JavaScript that says find this style tag by its ID and get the contents of it and toss it into browser cache. And then on subsequent pages, page visits throughout the site, the templates can instead reference that file externally instead of inlining it. So
it's just clever, but I mean, and so, you know, we can dig deep into this because I'd love to talk about it in context of SVG, because we've been playing with that.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But like, is it kind of provably good too? Like, can we watch the browser render faster in a way because it's not having to? Or is this kind of, is there some like theoretical purity that just feels good here? It certainly feels good to me.
Yeah. So I think it's really going to vary. So inlining in itself is kind of a pattern that we're having to use less and less, right? Because if we have access to HTTP2, we can push files instead from the server and reference them normally externally from the HTML. And more that's what we're doing as our sort of go-to first, you know, approach for CSS and JavaScript that's referenced in the head of the page. So that's great. But to me, the case for this new pattern becomes more interesting when we get to files that are kind of further down the page that would be really useful to inline, but we don't want to push them. And that's just because you can overuse server push. Like, you can get to a point where it actually starts to slow down rendering of a page, which is the opposite of what you're trying to do when you push files, right? So I think, like you mentioned, SVG, that's a great example of something that I would probably never server push, right?
15 so. Icons on a page. The server push stuff is, you know, a heck of a lot more than I do. Dave, I'm sure you do too. But are you talking about just link rel preload, or isn't there like another? I don't totally understand server push, to be fair.
Yeah, so I mean, link rel preload is in some server environments, the server knows to look for that in the markup of a page as a cue to push a file. But that's sort of like it's an implementation detail of different servers. I've never actually used it that way. So what we typically do is a little more manual, but you would have just an HTML file with a link to an external CSS file, like any page on the web. On the server, say it's Apache, and you'd had one of those little htaccess files that we all have, it would just have a little directive that says, if this is a request for an HTML file, then push site.css along with that HTML file. And it really is that simple. You know, it's just a line or two. And you'd typically qualify it to different pages and templates on a site. So you might want to only push.
That's pretty rad. But you're saying that if you do too much of that, if you put, say, hey, anytime an HTML file is download these 20 icons too, you've 20x the size of that request, and it's going to slow things down.
Yeah, because it clogs it up. They all come down at the same time. At a super high priority, right? So it's rare that you have that many things competing for initial render on a page. And I would think icons are probably not quite that high priority.
Is it like the browser? Like, if I push a style sheet, the browser's like, uh-oh, style sheet's coming, stop render. Or does it kind of all work async?
What's neat is if you look at a waterfall that has push and play. Ideally, when the browser encounters a link to, say, that CSS file, it'll go to request it and find that it's already in cache, right? Because it's been pushed.
Yeah.
So it kind of works that way. I wouldn't call it async, but you know, it gets pushed. It's much like inlining. And this, to be clear, is above my level of where I work on the web too, like the server side of it. But that's my understanding, at least. It's
almost like server-side bundling. And if you already have the pieces of the bundle, it's like, yeah, I don't really actually care. I'll just use the one. You can send it,
right?
I'll just use the
one. So, I mean, I tend to think of it as like a better way of inlining, like a more modern way.
Yeah. But do you ever like maintenance? Like, for me, it's like, okay, now I got to like maintain an Apache config. Like, that's about as fun as a dentist appointment, you know? Does that, you know, like now I have 10 problems.
Sure.
Do you ever feel that? Or, you know, if I timestamped my CSS files, I have to go and update the server config to get the right.
Yeah, I mean, that's
MD5 digest.
That's a great question. And I think, you know, it would vary by how you're using it. But like the example that Chris brought up, the link rel preload in the markup is, I think, one way that it's sort of like a helpful shortcut to not have to do the server configuration update.
It's kind of the lazy person's.
Yeah, approach. I mean, I think it's a great yeah. pattern. The weird overlap for me with that is that link rel preload means something to the browser also, and I think it's there's sort of like a gray area there where you're using it as a primitive for push, and I'm not exactly sure how that line is drawn, where you're saying actually I mean that, you know, you should push this file but not use it as a client side preload, which is, you know, like a declarative way to fetch a file now.
What's so funny about this too is what you push or what you preload or whatever, like it just gets like a chunk of text into some cache, but there's all kinds of nuance after that. Like if we're talking fonts, that's a whole can of worms of how they get used even after it's cached or whatever. And SVG is the same way. Like, oh, I can take my horse.svg file, chuck it in cache. So what? That means that if I put image source equals horse, great, it's cached, but that's not how I want to use that icon anyway.
Right. Yeah.
So what is it? Why is it useful? Like depending on what you put in that cache, how you then use it is still, it's not like there's one true way.
No, I don't think there is, but that's kind of powerful too, right? I mean, like once it's in cache, you can figure out how you want to
yes, right. It. I'm not saying don't use it. I'm saying that it's just so cool and interesting that what you
yeah,
do after
and
that.
And it's been neat following, just to clarify to listeners, Chris has been kind of building on this, this inline cache pattern, with SVG. And texting me offline to see the progress. And it's pretty neat, I think, you know, inlining it at first. And then hope I'm not like blowing up your blog post here. But yeah, getting those icons into the page, you know, on subsequent pages is an interesting challenge. And, you know, the first one that comes to mind is like Ajaxing them from that external URL that'll actually come from cache. But ideally we wouldn't want to.
JavaScript dependent, but so is the service worker. So
yeah,
there you
go. Yeah.
What really opened this, I don't know, interesting possibilities is that you brought up that there's this API called caches. It's just window.caches, isn't it? It's like amazing high level thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's independent of service workers, even though I first learned about
it. Right, because remember we were talking about the DOM and all that? Like, if in a service worker, you really can't access the DOM.
Right.
Cache is
just on the window objects.
It's just on the window.
You can just use it. Yeah.
Right in your JavaScript.
You don't even need a service worker. You can just put stuff in the cache and
just
pop stuff
anywhere
out,
you
list
want.
Stuff, whatever.
Yeah.
Anywhere you want.
Yeah. It's really neat because you can combine it. You know, use the caches API along with service workers too. And that's not, you know, a novel thing that's been going on since service workers came out. That's kind of the primary thing people do with service workers is toss files into these caches. But it has led to some interesting things for us lately. Like, you know, instead of using cookies, for example, to identify whether someone has been to a site before or if they're a return visitor, we can instead use a service worker to say, are all the files that, you know, we care about, are they in cache? And if so, let's send a header, a custom header along with every request that goes out from the browser that says, you know, this visitor has what it needs in cache. So
provably, you're not even
that.
Guessing. You're not even setting a cookie that's like probably has cache.
Yeah. And that was always faulty. I mean, you know,
right.
A lot of the performance recommendations that we would make at Filament and, you know, others would make through like the critical CSS kind of patterns and things like that kind of relied on some sort of cookie or something that wasn't, you know, it wasn't like a personally identifiable kind of cookie, like a tracking situation. It was more just, have you, you know, visited or not? Yeah. And if it's,
do you have to fill out a GDPR for CSS? Yeah.
That's an open question too. I mean, like my understanding is that style of cookie, which is used for, you know, it's the same one for every visitor to the site and it's not used to identify a user, is not really the kind that you know, is called out in GDPR.
It's different.
I don't know. I'm not a GDPR expert. I've asked GDPR experts about it, and they said, yeah, it's not even specifically cookies, you know, like this custom header pattern that I'm talking about is sort of reproducing the same thing that we would have done with cookies, just in a much better way, like a more reliable way that we can trust that if it says that files are cached locally, then we can sort of believe it.
Having access to this like actual cache is kind of
next level. Wild. This is how it works, people. If you can bear with some code explanation, you just like pseudocode, you call this caches API with just a string or whatever, and that string can be, in the case that, you know, I've seen Scott use it in and I've been playing with, you just grab like a DOM element and go outer HTML. You link, you know, there's an inlined SVG icon. Great. I grab it, grab the outer HTML. Now you have this chunk of SVG code. Now save it to caches at some URL. You have to, it's like a key value pair. You save it at like a URL.
Yeah.
So you save icons. It at slash
SVG.
Totally. It's slash horse.svg or whatever it is. And that probably should match a real file on the real file system. Like, it doesn't have to, but it would probably be smart to do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of funny. I was thinking it would be fun to do an experiment that packages a full website in just the first HTML file you download, you know, but then like kind of like explodes it out into local caches and makes a browsable site of files, you know, but just sort of like, you know, I would never recommend doing that, but as an experiment, it'd be kind of fun.
Well, it's almost offline-y then, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you know, you'd have to, that's sort of one of the great things about the service worker caches APIs is that they do work offline, right? So, it's interesting.
So anyway, this caches thing is so cool. You can just grab any text and, you know, and just dump it in cache. And then if the browser requests that same URL, it will automatically pull from that cache. You know, there's no, you don't have to tell it any, well, there is a little bit of an extra service worker step.
There's a little part.
Yeah. A little tiny one, but I'm not good at this stuff at all. And I was empowered to put a little repo together for this, and I was fascinated by it. And then I even, just because I thought this would be impossible somehow, but I thought, oh, maybe I'll try it, is to, you know, inline it at first, you know, like an SVG icon, chuck that in cache, and then on a subsequent page, not a subsequent page load, although you could do that, you just need a little server side something to differentiate whether it has the cache, like Scott was just explaining. I just did it so like index.html does the caching and some other page benefits from the cache if it can. So like homepage, subpage kind of thing. The subpage then presumably has it cached. If it doesn't, it will just pull it from the file system, which is not the end of the world, but you know, it will try to get it from cache first, and it probably is in there. And it doesn't have to use JavaScript to AJAX for it and then put it on the page at first. It can just use this SVG use syntax to look into that cache, grab the little piece of the SVG that it needs and render it, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, that's really neat.
It just means that it can render right away. It has the same spirit of critical CSS and all that. It's like a critical icon.
Yeah. To be clear, you're talking about like a use element with an href that goes straight to a file.
Exactly. Right.
External,
which is
file.
Not something that anybody uses in production right now so much. And the reason they mostly don't, I think, is because Edge never had support for it, because it's just a special element in SVG land, and it's meant to like clone a piece of SVG, like go grab this like fragment of SVG and re-render it. And it has the ability to go out to a file to get that fragment. It's just that one thing was never supported in Edge. It is more commonly used to have this like big chunk of icons on a page. Like, let's, you just toss it in the body, like 10 icons with the symbol element,
sure,
and then reference that. That was kind of cool. I was like a big supporter of that for a hot minute there. I kind of cooled off on it for various reasons. We could get all into that, but I don't know that we have time in this show.
Can I make a tiny distinction? Yeah. I think Edge has external SVG, but it fails on cross-origin.
Oh, really?
And, like, it doesn't have cores support. So if you put stuff on a CDN, like...
That's all it was? So this should work? Sides. This, like, if because it's reaching internally, it should be okay? But you can't set the cores there.
Like, in practice, it doesn't. If you used CloudFront or
there's a lot of nuance to use support.
Yeah,
need a website called Can I Use, but like the use has brackets around.
Can
it.
I use?
Oh, solid.
Right,
solid.
Buying domain.
Scott workshopped that yesterday in Slack. So
yeah,
but
it went over well yesterday. So that was even better.
Oh, good. I miss it. I was on vacation.
Thanks for the 25-minute setup.
Yeah.
Anyway, inlining is way cooler. And even if you do this technique, you really should probably then Ajax for the sprite anyway and replace it so that there's parity between how you're using that SVG file on all your different pages.
I think it's just SVG is tricky to get into a page right now, you know, from an external file, because that's not a... This isn't a problem for CSS. You know, we can just have a link rel style sheet, href, straight to the file, and it just loads it. But
no SVG href. That's not a thing.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, right? That would be really cool, especially to be able to get the full HTML, or sorry, the full SVG's markup into the DOM.
It would be without a shadow DOM, because that's the other weird thing about use, is that the second you use, you're in a shadow DOM, and shadow DOM has getting through that is not a fleshed out story either. That would be an alternative for the web platform to give us all the same shadow DOM piercing possibilities.
Right. Yeah. And that is an area I have not gone very far into. SVG.
You haven't pierced the shadow DOM, Scott?
just in demos.
What's fascinating that can always is CSS custom properties. So if you styled all of your SVGs and all the little parts of them to say basically like style equals, you know, fill or stroke, and then reference the name of a CSS variable, you can style those right through the shadow DOM, no problem.
Yeah, and that is really nice.
It is nice, but that, you know, talk about technical debt, you know.
Yeah, right.
Okay, well, that's it. I just wanted to talk about SVG for a while. We didn't even mention Grunticon, another one of Scott's, you know, kind of legacy projects. Not legacy in that it doesn't, you know, it's old or deprecated in any way, but just legacy as in famous. It's
been around a while. Yeah, well, I mean, internally at Filament, we've been asking that question, I think. Like, is it... I think it's due for an update, and we're trying to decide what parts are still useful to keep, you know, because more and more people are using like the use def sort of pattern, and we like that too. So I don't know. There are a lot of really, really good build tools now.
You know, it seems like everybody agrees on though is that SVG icon systems start with at the design dev level a folder full of individual icons.
Yes, yes, and there are quite a few patterns that get you from that, right? I'm not sure. Like, I almost want to open up some feedback on that in the Grunticon issues, just to see where people would like to see it go. You know, we still have it. I mean, it works fine still, you know, so we still have it in play and it does its job. But as a pattern that we'd want, I'm not sure.
Well, if the premise is that inlining SVG is good, that means like Grunticon itself like almost isn't enough or something. You need some kind of HTML templating thing in place that I'm not sure Grunticon can deliver all by itself. You know, like as I was playing around with my little demo, I had to throw Nunjux on there just to get it to pull, do an include. You need some kind of include syntax, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And Grunticon has a little thing like that. So like, you know, the kind of the first pattern is just to put a class on something like icon-horse. And that would reference, you know, a background image really. But as we know, that's pretty limiting. If you want to, you know, animate the SVG background or something like that, you're kind of out of luck. So there is an attribute you can use with Grunticon. I think it's data Grunticon embed. Something like that. And that'll actually It's neat because delivery wise, you download the icons once ever, and it's in a CSS file as little data URIs of the SVG files. But if you put that attribute on an element, it'll actually pull the SVG markup out of the CSS object and just dump it right into the element that you specified.
That's amazing. So it doesn't even do a network request. It does. It just
right.
It already has the data, so it just kind of upgrades the icon to be in line. It's genius.
Yeah, and the way we wrote the data URIs for that, they're not base64'd, you know, so they're just escaped SVG right in the CSS file, so they can go right into the DOM very easily and be animated. And so we use that a lot. If you went to the grunticon.com website, there are a bunch of demos that have embed attributes like that, and you can see the icons are animating, things like that. So it's a possible pattern, but the downside is it happens after the page is, you know, enhanced, right? The JavaScript comes in, it finds those elements with the attributes and injects the icon into them. So there's, you know, a slight delay, however long that takes.
I wonder if HTML imports, there's some kind of story there or something.
Yeah, I think, you know, the idea of some sort of client-side include that's really generic is just so necessary.
Why? I want to ask the web platform gods, why does HTML not have a tag or something, like some kind of native way to just put a chunk of HTML in another chunk of HTML? Is that so
funny? Oh, Chris, do you speak of HTML imports? Yes. Have you summoned me? Who summoned me?
No, not even that. Even more basic than that. Or I guess that is kind of that. But
yeah. I mean, that sort of pattern would solve a lot of these problems nicely, I think.
But there's got to be a reason it doesn't exist. You know? I don't know.
Yeah. For a long time, we maintained this project called Ajax Include, which had a jQuery dependency, but from an API perspective, I always found it really nice to work with, because you would just really on any element in the page, you would say data Ajax Include and just pass in a URL, and it would just, you know, fetch that file and inject it right in. And you could, you know, you could specify before or after, you know, things like that, prepend, append. But yeah, I would love if we had an attribute like that. That would be brilliant.
I just want it. Anyway, Scott, we've been talking forever. Thanks so much for the chat. It's been wonderful.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah.
This has been fun.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for your load CSS. We didn't talk about really either that much, but just that if you want to play with that link rel preload as something, and you want it to work in Firefox, I find it very useful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Thanks for mentioning that.
One day.
Yeah, that's one of our fun ongoing projects. I like to maintain that one.
Yeah, it's pretty helpful and pretty small. So, but thank you. And we should wrap it up. For people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
Well, you could go to filamentgroup.com and talk to us if you have any needs for website building or development or even performance audits, things like that. And as far as me, you could find me at scottgel.com or at scottgel on the various Twitter, GitHub, everythings.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you and for coming on. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.